Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Besides doing the shows, we would party our asses off for hours after the shows, and then we would get up, smoke weed, work out, do a sound check, start partying, do a show. I mean, what we put our bodies and our brains through to be able to do that, that type of schedule would absolutely never work.
Speakers up to 11 because it's time for Too Much Effing Perspective, the podcast that asks musicians and entertainers to relive their most Spinal Tap moments when nothing goes right and everything gets kind of weird. I'm your host, Alan Keller, a comedy writer in LA and former lead singer of the least heralded Chicago band, The Falling Will End Us.
And I'm your co-host, Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead and former lead singer of the least heralded Milwaukee band, The Vainglorious.
Our guest today is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Nick Hexum, who along with Aaron Peanut Wills, Chad Sexton, Tim Mahoney, and Doug S.A. Martinez make up the band 311.
We talked to Nick about the time his entire band nearly combusted like a gaggle of Spinal Tap drummers, how he got to play with his idol, Joe Strummer, from The Clash, and what nickname Snoop Dogg has for Nick.
So without further ado, let's go to the TMEP show.
It really puts perspective on things, though, doesn't it?
Not too much. It's too much fucking perspective now.
Alex, what happens every year on December 28th?
December 28th. Well, that's 4 days past my birthday, so I'm still getting used to being a year older.
No, you're actually trying to shame me because I forget your birthday every year. I'll remember next year. All right, I'll put it on the calendar. Anyway, December 28th is Be Happy Day.
Oh, that's right. Why don't you tell our listeners what Be Happy Day actually is?
Okay. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of Festivus, the holiday some non-religious people celebrate instead of Christmas and Hanukkah.
Is that Uncle Festus from the Addams Family?
Close. It's another TV reference.
Oh.
That's Seinfeld. They had a big Seinfeld episode.
That's
about
right.
It.
That's right.
Okay, it's a classic.
Got it.
Anyway, Festivus is for, I think, not so iconoclasts.
Okay.
If you're a real iconoclast, you'll come up with your own holiday from scratch. And that's what Be Happy Day is. It's a secular holiday I invented for my family that we've been celebrating ever since my daughters were, aware. And it's complete with its own rituals, decorations, legends, symbols, icons. And I wrote an origin story that I'd read every year, whether my daughters like it or not.
I got to say, Alan, it's just like you to do even the holidays the hard way.
Well, my wife Lois and I treat our family like an art project that never ends. So if you have an opportunity to put your creative spin on something, why not?
But isn't it true that Be Happy Day borrows some elements from normal people holidays as well?
We do the most important part of all holidays, which is presents. Yeah, because there's no way I was going to sell a different holiday. Oh, I said, we're going to go do charity for the day. Oh, I'm sorry. I wish my family were like that. They're not. And I appreciate when people do that. Yes, I do. But our holiday, Be Happy Day, it's a living thing that is constantly evolving. In fact, I'm still working on the story while my crafty wife and kids are always adding art to the Be Happy Day book or Bible.
Huh. Why do you call it Be Happy Day? I mean, while you are one of my best friends, you're not exactly the most chipper guy that I know. And so it seems like a kind of a weird name for it.
Be Happy Day is not spelled B-E. It's spelled B-E-E in honor of our late beloved Jack Russell Terrier B.
Ah.
And I thought, what better way to memorialize B than to make her the Santa Clausian character in our annual story?
Yeah. Well, I remember B. And that's really sweet. But Come on, Alan. There must be a Spinal Tap moment story in there somewhere from the history of Be Happy Day. Spill it.
It's an anecdote more than a Spinal Tap moment, but it is about Balloon Boy. And I won't go into it, but if you want to, email me at alan@tmepshow.com and I will send you guys the story in PDF form if you want. But anyways, so every year we go out on Be Happy Day, which again is December 28th, so stores are open. One of the reasons why we chose it, as well as for the sales, post-Christmas sales. Very wise of us.
You're thrifty.
Yes. And so we were going to the balloon store on our block, and we go in there, and they had a really cute puppy in a basket. And we're like, oh, that's a cute puppy. And this was a dog that they found in the parking structure that maybe someone who got it on Christmas Day just abandoned.
Ooh.
And so I said, well, I thought I had a better chance because I lived in the neighborhood of finding a home for this dog. So we named her Biscuit and we started trying to find a home for her. And of course, the Spinal Tap moment is I didn't want a fourth dog because we had three at the time, but Biscuit became our dog and part of the Be Happy Day tradition.
Oh boy. But I got to say, Alan, you have not cornered the market on making up holidays out of whole cloth. Our guest today, Nick Hexum from the band 311, actually invented 311 Day.
That's right.
It's a celebration that's held on or around March 11th every other year. And 311's fans come in from all over the world to celebrate and hang out together and hear the band play. And it seems like a ton of fun. It has become so popular that it actually is spanning 2 days this year in Las Vegas. It'll be a party.
Well, since we're talking about Vegas, I bet that 311 Day is not growing faster than Be Happy Day in terms of a cult-like following. We've seen exponential increases every decade since Be Happy Day was formed. And basically, I'm talking about in 2010, it was just my family of four. And now we've grown a little over a decade later to 16 devotees of Be Happy Day. So I don't know, pretty soon we're going to be as big as Scientology and the Moonies combined.
Growing like a weed, I got to say.
Wait, weed? That's 420 Day you're talking about, right?
Oh, 420 Day. Right, right. Well, Nick would appreciate that, being a well-known cannabis connoisseur.
Yes, he would.
So let's get to our chat with him. But first, listeners, if you like the stories that we're sharing here on Too Much Effing Perspective, please, please, please tell three friends about it. Your endorsement and word of mouth means a ton to us. We really appreciate it. Now, let's get to our conversation with Nick Hexum, but first, a short break.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit, or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
And now the leader of a band that has its own brand of non-alcoholic beer, 311's Nick Hexum. Nick, in the movie This Is Spinal Tap, a lot of drummers spontaneously combust. You, in your musical history, had an RV that spontaneously combusted, which is an awesome Spinal Tap moment. Can you retell that story for us?
Oh, yeah. This is a good one. So the year was 1993. We had just got a record deal and our first album, Music, came out. And so the very first tour we did, we had tour support and we rented a couple of expensive vans and overpaid a tour manager and
always
basically like blew through all of our tour support in a month. And then they were like, okay, so you're done. And we're like, no, we're going to go make this album happen. So we had to figure out how to tour on the cheap. And our drummer's dad, he did not spontaneously combust.
Good.
but his RV did. So our drummer's dad had this, I think it was a 1974, it wasn't a Winnebago, but it was like a Winnebago. It was a massive, probably as big as RVs got in the 70s. So, I mean, this thing was just huge. And we didn't have enough cargo space, so we decided to tow Tim, our guitarist's Volkswagen van, with our equipment in it. So it was like a 35, 40 foot long Winnebago with towing a Volkswagen van. We didn't really ask anybody if this was a good idea. We just did it because we thought, well, it would be nice on a day off if we want to like unhook the van and go drive around and stuff. So
aren't you supposed to ask that tour manager that?
We fired the tour manager. He was charging way too much. And we just got one of our homies from Omaha to be like an all-purpose tech of, you know, driving and lugging gear. And so
I'm sorry, let me just say something, Nick, and we won't digress too far from the story, but I do want to say you are totally contradicting Paul Westerberg's adage, which is we're not tourists, we're on tour, right? With that whole pulling the van thing, because you were fully anticipating being tourists while on tour.
Yeah, we wanted to see the country as we conquered it. So, so we played a show in, I think it was Columbia, Missouri, and then we were heading towards Kansas City, Missouri, if I remember correctly. We got the RV in LA and we made it that far. So the tour was about a week in. And we just filled up the RV with about 100 gallons of gas. It had two gas tanks. I think they were like 60 gallons a piece. So this was just tons of fuel. And we'd had a problem with the RV backfiring. And we'd stopped to have a mechanic adjust the carburetor or something. He couldn't fix it. So we're just like, deal with it. So every time you let off the gas, it was like rapping, boom, boom, bop, bop, bop. I guess we just have to deal with the sound of, you know, gunshots coming out of the bottom of our RV. And it's an explosion in the exhaust system. And if you backfire enough, basically what happened is it burst through the exhaust system and caught the floorboards on fire.
Oh, no.
And then that fire got into the gas lines. So Peanut had got a ride from a friend. So it was me and Tim and Chad and SA, the four of us. I'm driving the RV. We're going up a hill and I'm really putting my foot into it. I'm losing power. I'm starting to pull over. By the time I get over to the side of the RV, I can see that there's flames coming around in the rearview mirror, flames coming around the sides of the RV. And I was like, major fire, major fire. So I pull over and somebody throws the door open and the flames are coming in the RV. There's only one door. It's halfway down the passenger side. So we had no choice except to jump through the flames.
Wow.
To narrowly escape with our lives. And I was the last person out because I was driving and it was just a wall of orange. And I remember being doused in the heat. I got burned on both my front and back side of my body, just engulfed in flames, just for a second, you know, jumping through the flames and scampered up the hill off the side of the highway. And so we were like, okay, what are we going to do? It gets to the gas tanks and it's just like shooting out fire. And I remember there was a semi truck that cars had stopped. And then the semi was like, screw it, I'm going for it. And a semi drove through completely. He gets bathed in flame. It didn't catch on fire, but I mean, people trying to go for it because this fire was so big. It turned the interstate into gravel.
Wow.
It just completely cooked the road. But we were like, let's try and save the van, save the van. So we're going to try and unhook it. But we're like, no, it's going to blow. It's going to blow. It was straight out of a movie. And then like for the next 2 years, every time we see an RV, it's going to blow. It's going to blow. But we actually did buy another RV and just continue. We just got a slightly nicer one. We escaped with our lives, with no instruments. But luckily we had our shoes on and we had shorts and we each had our wallet and no shirt. No other possessions. Everything else went up in flames. And, you know, I remember saying to Chad, because he's really upset because it was his dad's RV. And I said,
my dad's going to kill us, man.
You know what's crazy is that his dad said, hey, if it catches on fire, just let it go. And I was like, wow, that's really prescient that he.
Oh, he said that? Really?
He said that before we left.
He said to me, hey, Nick, if it catches on fire, just let it go.
That sounds like a setup. Did you check any insurance policies the dad took out?
Well, we actually tried to file a claim and they said, well, you're using it for professional. It wasn't insured for that.
Right.
But I said to Chad, I was like, hey, man, we got each other. We got the songs in our heads and that's all we really need. So it was like this trial by fire and then move on with nothing but our songs and our dreams and each other. So we canceled that night's show. But the very next night, we were booked to play in our hometown of Omaha, and we borrowed equipment and just rocked the hell out of them and kept on touring. We rented a car, charging stuff on a credit card. And then we found a friend from Omaha whose dad was going to lend us some money to buy an RV, and we got one that was more mechanically sound, and we just kept going. So it was a crazy experience that I'll never forget.
Yeah, that's epic.
I bet that's the last time you play a Great White compilation tape in your touring van.
Absolutely.
Alan hates it when I bring out biblical stuff, but it's like you've been refined by fire, right? And come out pure on the other end.
Yeah.
But it reminds me, you know, I was a concert tour manager, and one of the bands that I was tour managing was this trio, a combination of guys from the UK and New Zealand. And my story is slightly less dramatic, but I'll close the loop, which is in the summer of 92, we had our van in Los Angeles, and the band was signed to RCA Records, which was down on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood in a really dicey part. Again, this was 30 years ago.
Yeah, it's come up since then, but yes. Yeah,
it has come up since, but it was quite rough. So anyway, being the thrifty tour manager that I was and trying to, you know, preserve my band's tour support, we parked the van curbside next to RCA, as opposed to maybe paying $5 in the lot across the street that had an attendant. So we went up, kind of met with some people, and we were able to, you know, back in those days, no one had cell phones. So we were like using the phones in the record company office to call long distance and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they were calling the UK to catch up with friends and family. So we ended up staying there a lot longer than we planned. And long story short, went back down to the van only to realize that someone had popped the locks and cleaned us out. I mean, instruments, personal bags. I think my suitcase was still in there. My duffel bag was gone. The first words were, when we opened the door, like, where are the guitars? And we just realized everything was gone. But we still had our clothes. We still had our wallets. And that's the way we ended up driving from... We were on tour with Sarah McLachlan, actually, at the time. So we ended up driving from L.A. to Milwaukee to kind of connect back up with Sarah. We only had the clothes we were wearing. I had some extra clothes in my suitcase, but I didn't change just to show solidarity with those guys as we drove for 3 days. But I really know that feeling. And as traumatic as those things are, it's an incredible bonding time among people on the road to go through something like that.
The very next year, we had a show in Vancouver, and it was always really traumatic crossing the Canada border because we were like wanting to make sure we got rid of every little bit of weed because it was like such a huge part of what we did. So we got through the border and we're super stoked. We're just driving into Vancouver and all of a sudden, boom, the axle broke. And you'd have to hit a huge tow truck to tow an RV. And then they said, well, we're going to be able to fix it, but it's going to be a week for us to get the part there.
Right.
I called my dad. I'm like, please just charge the axle on your credit card. He did it, but we had to stay there for a week. So it turned out that we played at this place called the Town Pump in Vancouver. Yeah. We got super drunk, rocked the shit out of the place. And then the lady who ran the club, she was like, well, I'm a foster parent and we have extra beds. So we stayed at her house with her foster kids for like a whole week.
Oh my goodness.
Did she try to get you to take any off her hands?
It was a weird vibe.
Some extra roadies, yeah.
You were looking for a tour manager.
It was a weird vibe, but she was very nice. We never got a chance to thank her properly, but it was really cool. I guess the town pump is no longer there, but we just had to cancel gigs and wait a week. We just played touch football all day long waiting for it to be fixed.
That's fun.
Could be worse and certainly could be a worse places to get stuck, so...
Yeah.
I will share a quick town pump story, which is I was Radiohead's tour manager on Pablo Honey, and we went to Vancouver and played the town pump. And I don't remember what happened exactly, but Creep was a big hit and there was a lot of excitement about the band. And so almost all the shows were sold out and the crowds were really almost in some cases too enthusiastic for Tom York's liking, if you can imagine such a thing.
Yeah, he was annoyed.
Certainly, sometimes. Anyway, the crowd was just a really mellow Vancouver crowd. They weren't super stoked, and maybe there was even some chatter around the bar or something like that, you know? And the band did its set, came off stage. We were back in the dressing room, and the crowd was calling for an encore, and Tom was not happy about whatever it was. And so the lighting director was sent back out on stage to say, sorry, our singer's lost his voice, so we can't do an encore for you tonight. And there's a boo in the background. But it was such an odd thing. That's my town pump memory.
What is he talking about? The voice sounded fine a few minutes ago, eh? Like, how did he lose it that fast?
You know, Nick, I was researching you and so many of your influences came up and they're my influences, like The Clash, Petty, Soundgarden, Beach Boys.
XTC, I like your shirt.
XTC, Jane's Addiction, right? Those are all, would you say, significant parts of your musical blending.
Very much so.
So it's interesting that you took these eclectic influences and created a multi-platinum band, and I took the same ingredients and I'm doing a podcast in my bedroom. It just doesn't seem fair. What did I do wrong? It's like I baked a cake, but I forgot all of the baking soda. I don't understand it. Anyway, I'm also a really big Clash fan, and I find it interesting how you guys incorporated reggae music into your sound in an entirely different way than The Clash did and The Police. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. The Clash absolutely blew my mind when I was 13. It was when I got to junior high and I met a new kid and his older brother had all these punk rock records. And I just was like, whoa, what is this? And I just became completely obsessed. First, I loved the punk rock energy of the simple stuff of Police and Thieves and White Riot. But then I just loved the attitude that anything goes. Like, they actually had one of the first hip hop hits with Magnificent Seven, and these songs on Sandinista were songs that the OG hip hoppers would breakdance to in the early 80s. Anywhere they wanted to go, they'd have a gospel song, a blues song, a jazz song, a funk song, Cajun. I mean, they would just do anything. And I just loved that attitude and that diversity. And so I always wanted us to stay really eclectic. Anything we liked in our music, we would just put it in there. Oh, and you asked about reggae, and, you know, cannabis was always a part of our bonding. Let's get stoned and explore some weird ideas. Now we still explore weird ideas without the cannabis, and I actually can get as far out there as I need just naturally by going for the eclecticness and keeping my listening habits changing. And of course, it's now so much easier to discover new music and just go down all these different rabbit holes. This new artist that I'm totally geeking out is this woman, Madison Cunningham. She's so dope. It's like Joni Mitchell meets Fiona Apple, but funky instrumentation. And she's just a ripping guitarist and cool baritone guitar riffs and stuff. So there's always something new to explore. We grew up in Omaha, but our mind was always like, let's get to the coast. Went on car trips with my dad, listening to Beach Boys and just daydreaming of Southern California. And when I heard Bob Marley's Natty Dread, I was like, I got to get to Jamaica and
But let's be honest, Omaha is the Jamaica of the Western Middle West. If you're going to compare it to South and North Dakota, I mean, that's what Jamaica is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I think you said something really great in that London Calling is such an eclectic album. And there used to be a book that asked all these artists to pick the album they would take on a deserted island, right? And obviously, if you pick something that's straight ahead, sounds the same every day, it's not going to last you that long. But like Sgt. Pepper and Skylarking with XTC and London Calling, I mean, yeah, you're not going to get sick of it.
Yeah, I love diversity and eclecticness and exploration. As long as you keep your curiosity going, then music can be just a never-ending journey, both as a listener and as a writer.
What do you think's the most eclectic 311 album?
Well, you know, the Blue Album is our third album, and that was the one that was kind of our breakout. We had an MTV Buzz clip that was a really big deal in like 1996, like the heavy, heavy rotation and songs that everyone was talking about. And so that album went triple platinum. And then after that, our follow-up was Transistor, and we did something really ballsy in retrospect. We said, let's just go in it completely all these crazy different directions and not worry about whether the songs are going to be good live necessarily. Like, I was very into trip hop, Massive Attack and Portishead and Dub and King Tubby and all this production techniques and stuff. So I would say that Transistor is kind of like our either Sandinista or London Calling, like a very, very eclectic album, but it tanked. People were like, I thought they were going to do the rap rock songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we basically totally defied expectation. But now that album is our most beloved album because there's so much creativity. Mm. Like when we decided to do a camping event, we were like, we're going to ask people to come to the panhandle of Florida and go camping in the totally sweltering heat of the summer. We've got to do something really special. I said, tell them we're going to play Transistor in its entirety.
That's awesome.
And then people are like, oh my gosh, I'm definitely in it. So we did that because it's been such a beloved album.
We had kind of a fun part of our conversation with Buck Meek of Big Thief, talking about how music critics describe bands. And one description of Big Thief was rustic loft rock. And Buck was just like, oh my God. What's the craziest description of 311 that you ever heard?
I can think of one insulting one. This was back in our very first year in Omaha. And this other band that we were competitors with, and I don't remember their name right now. See, so we won. Anyway, this competition going with a local Omaha band.
Spike in the football.
Fuck the Red Hot Chili Peppers, right? Who's heard of them?
The Chili Peppers figure into the story. So this other band was in charge of making the billing of this festival that someone put together. And they described their band as James Brown meets Nirvana. And then they described us as Red Hot Chili Peppers styled funk. So like basically trying to say that we were just nothing more than an imitation of the Chili Peppers, which was actually, it was a problem for us in our first year. They're like, you guys are just a knockoff of the Chili Peppers. I was like, no, we're doing this other thing and the other thing. And like, no, but luckily that tag didn't follow us around for very long. And I got a chance to record with Joe Strummer, and he put together this super group for the South Park soundtrack. And it was me on guitar, Flea on bass, Tom Morello also on guitar, DJ Bonebreak from X on drums, Benmont Tench from Tom Petty's band, you know, Heartbreaker. That was the backing band with Joe Strummer doing this rockabilly 50s song. And I was just a kid in the candy store to just be surrounded with these heroes. It was really cool.
And mention who the producers were.
Yes, Rick Rubin and George Draculius operating the Vaders.
Yeah.
So how was it working with your hero, Joe Strummer?
We had had a manager in LA that was managing him. He was doing the Mescaleros. This was like 99. And they say, we're going to have this little dinner thing going on. Once you come on over, you can meet Joe. And we were like, okay, yeah. And me and my manager, Adam Raspler at the time, we go over to this house party in the Hollywood Hills. And we go in, and there's this boombox over there. And there's this like cool Cuban music just coming out kind of loud. And I go over close to it and I see there's this little alien head sticker. And I was like, that's our sticker. And I was like, what the hell? It's our sticker. And the manager guy was like, yeah, that's Joe's boombox. I was like, shut up.
Wow.
And when I meet him, I was like, how is this possible? He was like, oh, yeah, I got a new boombox and I thought I'd make it look cool with some stickers. And boomboxes, if you remember, was such a part of the Clash's imagery. Like always, they had them in their music videos and stuff. So I was like, my whole existence is validated. It doesn't matter if people call me a chili pepper knockoff or whatever. Like Joe Strummer likes 311. And yeah, we became friends and just talked and talked. And he told me, he said, you're going to want to know your family tree as you get older. You're going to find it really interesting. So learn about your ancestors. And I've found that to be really, really interesting. Something I want to pass on to my kids. And he told me inside stories. I was like, so what happened with the Clash? And he was like, honestly, I pulled a stunt where I was arguing with the guys and I disappeared. I just went to Paris for a while and didn't tell anyone where I was going. And my manager told me it would be a good idea. And the other band members said, fuck it, we're done with this. And he was like, it wasn't a good idea.
Oh, geez.
So him sharing these really personal stories.
But he fired Mick Jones, though, and then he had that horrible last Clash album with his buddy. They co-wrote the songs together, right?
Another story he said about that, he said, and you know, immigrants or where it's at, you know, in the original Clash, we were all people from different places. Like Joe was born in Turkey and he was felt like kind of an outsider. And Paul Simonon and Mick Jones, they were recently from other countries of the families. They weren't old school Londoners and upper class or anything like that. He said, you're going to want to have immigrants, because when I had the next version of the Clash, I had all these London insiders, the cool kids. It wasn't the same.
Did you ever listen to the Spotify documentary that Chuck D narrates?
Yeah, with Chuck D. Fascinating.
Wasn't that great?
That was so good.
Tell them our Bill Stefani story, Alex.
Oh, sure. Well, we have a really great episode with Bill Stefani, who was the original president of Def Jam Records. And of course, in that context, worked closely with Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons. And as a college student, Bill was friends with Chuck D, and he was a DJ at the college radio station. This is the early 80s. So he was really pretty early in bringing hip hop to radio, even college radio. And they had another friend, Hank Shockley. And through Bill's connection with the radio station, he was able to see The Clash at a sold out show in New York City, which just changed his life. But in working with Chuck, he really encouraged that Chuck figure out how to create the mashup of The Clash and Run DMC. And then Chuck and Hank had this wacky idea of bringing Flavor Flav into the mix, because they said Chuck is this profound, prophetic, almost preacher, like almost like if MLK rapped, right? And they needed some sort of comic relief to help it land. And Bill was like, no, we can't do that. That's going to submarine this whole thing. And he ultimately stood down from that position. He's like, that's the best overriding decision I've ever experienced.
Yeah. That was a major juxtaposition. No, and Public Enemy, that's another influence that we listen to so much. If you listen to a song called Visit on our first album, and then listen to She Watched Channel Zero off It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, there's some similarities because they like sampled Slayer. Yeah. So we definitely took some influence from them, and we got to play with them a few times, and definitely an honor.
Oh, you did? How was that?
It was great. It was actually in Scotland, in Glasgow. We got paired up with them. But then we came out doing our rock thing, and I remember the crowd was like, we came here for hip hop, not rock. That's not a good Scottish, but
it's okay. We'll take it.
Yeah.
It wasn't as good as your Canadian.
Yeah. Thank you.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
With Kizik hands-free shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
So one of the successful 311 projects, I guess, that you have undertaken over multiple years is the Unity Tour. You've taken out a range of bands that certainly are reflective of your broad influences. You've been out with Snoop Dogg, The Wailers, The Roots, G-Love and Special Sauce, Ziggy Marley, among many others.
Yeah.
And I was curious, naturally, any Spinal Tap moments with Snoop Dogg?
Well, I love that I have my own Snoop Dogg nickname. Whenever he sees me, he's like, Slick Nick. So my kids love the fact that I have my own nickname from Snoop. And he really got into the Unity concept. Like at the end of his shows, he would be like, say peace, peace, love, love, unity, unity. Like working the crowd into this peace and love and unity chant. And so it was really, really cool. He travels deep. He has got uncles and people that just hang out on stage. And yeah, it's a very big posse, but he was great. And yeah, I love the word unity. It was actually the original name of the band. We had an earlier incarnation that we were called Unity. And then we found out there was already a punk rock Unity out in California, so we changed our name.
To the New Originals.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Yes. I love that. And speaking of Spinal Tap, I, you know, in preparation for this, I had forgotten how many things from our vernacular came from that movie.
Yeah.
Yet I had not seen it in so long, but there's just so many. Like whenever you're getting lost on the way to the stage, hello, Cleveland. And the whole thing about when the taxi driver is talking about people don't understand what it's like to have loved and lost like Frank. And they roll up the window on him because English people do not want to hear about Frank Sinatra. But there's just so many things in the modern rock band's vernacular that came from that movie.
And how many 311 albums got that two-word review?
That's right. Yeah, we've had some harsh reviews, that's for sure.
Any funny ones?
I can't think of any really funny ones. I know that our last one, the iTunes review said, lead singer Nick Hexum always takes it easy. And I was like, okay. I don't think you mean that as a compliment.
Oh, classic.
Well, you know, that really is so counter to your story because, first of all, I'm sorry, getting signed within a year, give me a break. That's not fair. Okay.
And that's the British model. You guys co-opted the British model, really.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So you come out here, you're 17 years old, and you get a job at Guitar Center, right?
Right.
Especially at that time, that's got to have been loaded with celebs and...
Absolutely. I was in the pro audio department, and guys from Guns N' Roses and Stevie Wonder and just all these rock gods would come in and buy up equipment with their big advances. And I got to meet Anthony and Flea from the Chili Peppers at that time. And I felt like in over my head. But the thing was, I loved like the Jane's Addiction and this kind of alternative thing that was happening, but I couldn't find people like that. So I moved out first by myself when I was 17. And then everybody that I linked up with from Musicians Connection and the Recycler and those people, they were all metalheads. It was all this Great White and all this sort of Sunset Strip
Hair metal.
Yeah, hair metal kind of stuff. So I really realized that the best people I could get in a band with were my homies from high school. And I had a band with Tim doing alternative stuff in high school. So I realized, all right, regroup, go back to Omaha. And then we started 311 and moved out here together. It wasn't like a year. I mean, there was a couple years of floundering around with different lineups. And then our first gig as 311 was in 1990. And then we got signed in 92. So it took a couple years, but still.
So you're 22, right?
Yes, 22 years old.
So you can't say to our audience that I struggled for 22 years before I was signed. You can't say that. That doesn't count.
No.
That's still not fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were very blessed, but it seemed like a long time at the time because we were like touch and go on the money, just eating Top Ramen and stuff. And there was a little bit of grumblings like, are we going to make it or not? I was like, yes, we're going to. Just wait, just wait. And I'm like calling up record companies and lawyers and just BSing, like name dropping different A&R people who, so-and-so is thinking about signing us. You might want to check out our tape and just making stuff up wholesale. Doug Morris from Atlantic, I'm like, never met the guy or whatever, but I'm just name dropping and it panned out.
Oh my God. That's so funny. I had a band called The Falling Willendas. We put out some albums in the 90s.
I remember that name.
Thank you. I'm so glad when that happens. Before I was in a band called Women's Liberace, and I remember the first press Women's Liberace got was a press release that I faked, and it was a totally apocryphal story. And then I sent it, and they printed it verbatim.
Wow.
Like the exact thing. And so there's a total mythology out of the shoot. Alex has a great story faking your identity at Capitol Records.
Yeah, yeah. He loves, this is just a source of endless mockery. But yeah, so I had connected with Amos Newman, Randy Newman's son. And
right. I've actually talked to him before.
Have you? Yeah. So when I first met him, he was doing A&R at Epic. And then he moved over to Glenn Ballard's label, which was sort of a boutique within Capitol. And so I got in touch with Amos. And my first contact with him was as a manager, as a music business person. And I called him and I said, you know, I'm representing this guy. I think he's really good. His name is AJ Blackwelder. And I'd love to have you hear him. Could he come up and play a couple songs for you? Or could we come up? And Amos was like, sure. I followed up and said, you know what? I can't make it, but I'm just going to send AJ up on his own, right?
Nice. Nice pivot.
Yeah. So I headed to Capitol Records with my guitar and trying to look cool. And the last time I'd been there was actually as Radiohead's tour manager. So it was a completely different vibe showing up there in this way. But so I played a couple of songs for Amos on my guitar and my bullshitting did not result in a deal. But I love that scrappy spirit.
Yeah. And I also, along the lines of harmless lies, I wanted to save money getting into clubs. So I don't know how I got the idea to do this, but I would call up Club Lingerie or the Coconut Teaser or the Roxy during the day and be like, I'm Nick Hexum from Cream Magazine. I was assigned to do a review of the show tonight. I just wanted to make sure I was on the list. And if you just say it with confidence, you're all set.
That's a damn good idea.
You know what, Nick? Okay, we're just really showing this side of ourselves. My wife and I lived in West Hollywood for a number of years, and I still had all my old laminates and stuff from being on tour. So Cheap Trick was doing a four-night stand at the House of Blues on Sunset, which I don't even think is there anymore, if I'm not mistaken.
No, yeah, it's gone.
But they were doing full albums. So they were doing like Heaven Tonight, Dream Police, and you know they did like four of their best records back-to-back and in their entirety. So I wanted to go see Heaven Tonight. And having been at the House of Blues as a tour manager, I knew exactly how it worked. I knew where the stage door was. I knew that they had very light security there. I knew that if I had my laminate on, no one would even look. So that's what I did. I just literally put my old Radiohead laminate on and just walked right up the walkway there and walked through the door and I was in. It's taught me, and I've actually told my daughters this, if you're in a situation where you want to be, but you're not sure whether you should be, take on the persona of like, you are absolutely supposed to be there. You know exactly what you're doing. And 95% of the time, no one's even going to question you.
Yeah. I used to take the foundation room elevator from the back parking lot up to the foundation room. And I wanted to go to a show at House of Blues. And then they take the stairs down into the show. And they never knew.
Yeah. Yeah. Between you and me, how much money do we owe the House of Blues? I hope they're not listening.
That was a great venue. I saw Spinal Tap there. They did a reunion show at the House of Blues Hollywood. It was like a one-off thing.
That's insane.
Yeah, I saw Paul Simon there. I saw Steve Earle, Chris Isaak. I mean, amazing shows. And did you ever go to the Gospel Brunch?
Yes, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Saw Etta James perform there a few times. And they always had this, like, the best hip-hop shows, like Erykah Badu, The Fugees, The Roots, De La Soul, Tribe Called Quest. Like, oh, man, we would just get down all night there.
This is probably quite a few years ago, and I think this is when you were first starting to get some money from your records and stuff. You owned a gold 69 Lincoln Continental with suicide doors.
Correct.
What's that?
What?
What are suicide doors?
The 60s Lincolns had suicide doors open forward, like the limo that JFK was in. But like the coolest lines to those cars, and I always just something about the suicide doors and the lines of that car. So yeah, when we got signed, I used my portion of the advance to go out and get a 69 Lincoln and had it repainted with really like a lot of metallic flake gold paint and a huge booming sound system. And I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world.
And that's from the era when Detroit really knew how to make cars, right? Every year was something special. I remember asking Radiohead's managers, this is some years down the road, I'd said, like, who of the guys has done something like bought an actual rock star car? And they said that Tom was friends with Flea. Flea had a Tesla Roadster and had convinced Tom to get one. So I want to know, what's another example, either from you or any of your bandmates, of some sort of rock star hijink, something that's kind of as flamboyant as that awesome car you bought?
Well, I bought a private island. I'll just leave that there, hanging in there.
Next topic.
The plane. Yeah.
That actually leads to my next question, which is, you guys have been really quite entrepreneurial as 311, right? The Unity Tour is, again, an initiative that you guys launched and have led for multiple years. You guys have done a beer with the Nebraska Brewing Company. You have done a cannabis vapor pen under the 311 brand. You have actually sponsored a NASCAR team, right? All this kind of stuff. And you revealed earlier that you are now a major league sports owner. And Dell, you'll have watching parties on the island, and we'll be looking for our invitations. Let us know when to show up at the tarmac, Nick.
Yeah, well, the island got completely worked over by hurricanes the year of Katrina, and I had to get out from underneath some serious losses that
I've called Mother Nature remodeling.
Yeah. Yes,
yeah,
just washed over the whole island. But you know, yeah, 311, we have our own cruise. We have 311 Day, which is like our own convention. People come from all over the world, and we're doing two nights in Vegas at the Park Theater there, which is just a beautiful, very high tech. There's 4K screens everywhere you look. It's not quite the Sphere, but it's a really dope theater. And now I'm part of a tech startup that is trying to be a talent network to have artists be able to get the services they need to be creative without having to sign a crappy record deal. And you can find out more at skp.io. It's really exciting to try to do something for legacy purposes of making a platform to help free musicians to be creative. So it's like a place where you could go and just get a publicist, a distributor, a radio team, all the different things that a label would do without having to sign a label deal.
Yeah.
So it's pretty exciting.
Well, that's so cool. And I guess that my question was going to be, with all these entrepreneurial initiatives, many of which have worked out great, what hasn't worked?
Well, I definitely took a big beating on the private island thing. That was not something that I really did the math before.
Sounded good.
Yeah, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun for a while. We've been pretty fortunate, and I think one thing about our band is that we always have put touring first. We take our business model more inspired by the Grateful Dead's of the world, where like we are going to keep a direct relationship going with our fans by being a live band first, you know, tour every summer, and then we'll work albums around that. So we're not living or dying by the success of our last album. We're a catalog band and we go out and just really focus on doing the best show that we can. And just keeping an attitude of gratitude, realizing that we are so lucky to be able to do this, that people care about our music, and that we have a special lineup of the guys that we stumbled together with. And, you know, we're one of the longest running original lineup bands that there is. U2 has got us beat. Radiohead has us beat, but I don't know if they're going to be active anymore or what. You probably would know better, Alex, but... You know, definitely ZZ Top had us beat, but they lost Dusty. So we're up there with one of the 33 years original lineup bands.
That's unbelievable.
We stay grateful for it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's really special. Well, Nick, where can our listeners keep up on the latest from you and 311?
My socials are easy. Nick Hexum on Twitter or Instagram or, well, X now, I suppose. Threads also. We hadn't been overseas in a long time, so 311 is finally getting back overseas. We're going to festivals in Europe, so we're very excited. And we've got a new album that we're just putting finishing touches on, getting ready to start mixing. So please follow 311 on socials to stay up with us.
So that Instagram name, devastatedislandinvestment.com, that's not you guys. No. I just wonder.
No.
Atlantis 2. There's an Atlantis 2. Is that yours?
Buyislandcheap.com, you know, as is.
Well, thank you, Nick. This has really been a lot of fun.
Yeah, super fun.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you guys for having me.
Now, remember, listeners, all you got to do is dial 311, that 311 on your rotary telephone. If you run out of cannabis, beer, you want to book a cruise, or to secure your reservation on a hurricane-smashed offshore island. I hear Nick makes home deliveries. Thanks to my friend Joel Mark, who manages another one of our favorite guests, Dave Perner from Soul Asylum, for helping bring Nick Hexum to the show. Too Much Effing Perspective is a Milwaukee Talkies original. Our editor is Gretchen Kilby. Our music composer is J.K. Harrison. Please follow us on Instagram at TMEP Show. Visit our website at tmepshow.com to sign up for our mailing list. And find our other episodes featuring rock stars, comedians, and entertainment luminaries whose bizarro stories we enjoy and we think you will too on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Although it would be as great as having armadillos in our trousers, this podcast is not affiliated with This Is Spinal Tap, and no person or entity connected with the film has sponsored or endorsed its content. This podcast is not affiliated, sponsored, or licensed by Authorized Spinal Tap LLC or Century of Progress Productions.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Evergreen Podcast Network.